Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash-Burnett.
Hello, and welcome back to Berlin Inside Out, the foreign affairs podcast in association with the German Council on Foreign Relations that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany. I'm Benjamin Tallis, Senior Research Fellow here at DGAP and head of its action group Zeitenwende. And I'm here with my friend and co-host, Aaron Gash-Burnett, a journalist and analyst of German politics. Aaron, today we're tackling a big question. Specifically, how did German foreign policy evolve into what it is today? And we're going to go quite far back in order to do that, but also to ask how Germany got so rich. How did it actually acquire all that economic power, which has been at the heart of its influence in world politics in the last few years? Where did it come from? How has it been deranged and derailed over the years in various ways? And at what cost has it actually been bought? And as that's a big task, indeed, it requires a broad scope. And so we're going to be tracing the historical origins of current German foreign policy mindset, as well as its economic might. And to do so, we're going to have to go back way before the first German unification of 1871, so before the Kaiserreich period, into the period where Prussia was one of Europe's great powers, and indeed understanding how it rose to be such.
That's right, Ben. And the reason we're doing that is that that history is still influencing German foreign policy, both consciously and through unconscious bias, I would say. One thing among many that we're looking at is where German imperial thinking comes from. You mentioned German unification in 1871. You mentioned Prussia. All of those periods come into play, not even just the recent German history in the 20th century and 21st. So what do I mean by this gaze on imperial thinking? We've talked on Berlin Side Out before, particularly in our series on the Baltics, when we spoke to Professor Ulrike von Hirschhausen about because Germany renounced imperialism for itself, it doesn't necessarily mean that today's Germany isn't trapped in imperial thinking. And this comes out in its foreign policy. One example of how that shows up now is in a recent poll, and you can find that poll in our show notes. And that poll asked Germans about whether Ukraine should give up Russian-occupied territories if, by doing so, it would end the war. Now, 40% said yes, 48% said Ukraine should keep fighting, and 12% didn't know. Now, it's not really the fact that these results are the way that they are that's the most notable thing about this poll, is what I would argue here. It's that German public broadcaster ZDF thought it was a perfectly fine question to ask in that way. So obviously, we would object to framing like that. For one, it implies that Germany has a say, or should indeed have a say, over what are and should be Ukraine's sovereign choices, like whether and when to negotiate with Russia, which, by the way, Russia has said it's not interested in any negotiations that don't end with complete UN legitimation of Russian occupation of the whole of Ukraine. But what else is coming up here for you when you see a poll like this? I mean, how might our Central and Eastern European allies look at questions that are in public debate that are framed this way?
Well, indeed, it is indicative of that latent imperial gaze that I think still conditions Germany's view of Europe, that the decisions of the great powers today are what that matters, and others are effectively reduced to pawns in this game. Now, that's a caricature of what current policy is, but it does have an enduring impact. The notion that somehow countries should have spheres of influence and that those who are from smaller states must accept simply the will of larger states is not something that we can endorse, but is nonetheless something that resonates not only in German foreign policy thinking, but others too. Of course, however, in Central and Eastern Europe, there's a particular historical resonance here with the notion of the division of spoils, or the division of the Zwischenländer, the countries in between Germany and Russia in particular, formerly having been in between Germany or Prussia, Russia, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire. And of course, everyone knows, I think, about their famous divisions of Poland, but it was also the rest of the lands in between those countries that suffered from that kind of approach. And of course, that comparison has been made in the way that Germany dealt with Russia over Nord Stream, for example, going over the heads of Central and Eastern Europe, very much about us, without us, was the mantra in Central Eastern Europe, in understanding the implications of that decision. And of course, they were proved right when Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, as if they hadn't been proved right already by the Russian annexation of Crimea and its consistent policy over the years. The other thing I think is important to emphasize here is the understanding of how Germany actually got rich, how it has actually indeed exercised such power, and on whose back and whose resources this initially came. And so how that might, much like any colonial power built its might on its colonies, so too did Germany to an extent. And that's something that's not perhaps sufficiently recognized, that intra-European colonial history, which is something that we've talked about on a number of episodes of Berlin Inside Out, but which we explore today in more detail with Albrecht Ritschl, who is professor of economic history at the London School of Economics. And as you may guess from his name, a German, but relocated to London. So one who has his very own version of German Side Out, perhaps, Aaron.
Yes, indeed. So he, as you said, he is a historian at the London School of Economics. He's also a member of the action group Zeitenwende, which we're both a part of and that you head up here at the council, Ben.
As well as the history, we also get stuck into the present difficulties that Germany's economic and trade model has caused for it, especially in its relation to geopolitics, but also on its own basis. So what are the contradictions in Germany's current model? How does that relate to its difficulties over energy supply? And where can it draw historical inspiration from in regaining its competitiveness? Together with Albrecht Ritschl, we bust some of the myths that actually condition this debate and understand, as Aaron mentioned earlier, that selective reading of history is no real guide. So it's important to get the full view, which is why we turned to Albrecht.
And Ben, since you just mentioned that whole selective reading of history, I'm reminded of something you mentioned earlier about Germany being historically as being one of the three imperial powers that partitioned Poland, for example. As we've often discussed on Berlin Side Out before, history is not simply what you remember, but what you don't remember. And that's, for example, something that is not, I would say, discussed nearly as much in Germany. You know, what exactly the role that Germany played in historical decisions like that one, the partition of Poland, for example.
That's absolutely right. And other underappreciated aspects of this history include when talking about the Wirtschaftswunder, Germany's economic miracle, the role actually of the occupying powers, were they colonial powers? You can argue that question, the UK and the US in particular, in providing not only a security shield, but also in forgiving Germany's debt that helped fuel the Wirtschaftswunder, the economic miracle that saw Germany get back on its feet and restore eventually its material reputation, and which led to a cultural renaissance that enabled it to restore its moral reputation as well. So busting through these myths, busting through selective readings is what Berlin Inside Out is about.
We started by asking him a rather light question about the origins of Germany's economic model, which of course has been at the center of so many of its foreign policy decisions. So let's listen in.
So talking in the big sweep of history, in broad brush terms, how did Germany get to be the kind of economic power it is today? And is that model in difficulty?
Okay, you give me 2 hours for the answer. there are several things to think about here. One is energy resources, and it's of course not by accident that I put this first. Historically, that was of course coal deposits. By some basically historical accidents and things that had nothing to do with economics, the Kingdom of Prussia came to be sitting on some of Europe's best coal deposits, which then provided a more or less straightway shortcut into industrialization. It's a bit more difficult than that, but that's one way to start. A second way to start it is what is sometimes called the Big Banana, which is a manufacturing belt that extends from nowadays from Scandinavia all the way into northern Italy, passing through the British Isles, parts of France, Belgium, Netherlands, eastern France, Switzerland, also northern Spain and Catalonia are part of it historically. Question is why we have this manufacturing banana. That seems to have to do with accumulation of skills already back to the Middle Ages, and there are some of the most fancy theories of why this is. Let's not get into this now. The important thing is there was a deep knowledge of how to do things combined with easy availability of rich natural resources, and that was like the toxic brew that generated industrialization and the beginning of climate change.
Right. And I mean, Germany was a relative latecomer to some of that industrialization, but boy, did then it make up for that.
That's a typical thing, and we will probably have to talk about this later in today's discussion. Germany is a latecomer to almost everything. The Germans are slow, but once they get the hang of something, they actually do it.
So from this rich manufacturing and resource base, which then gets turbocharged in the 19th century, particularly the second half of the 19th century in the German lands, which then, of course, become the Prussian Empire. And that unification has a stimulating effect as well.
Absolutely. Of course, big politics did play a role. The Prussians used to be a pretty poor country, but they had a small but efficient standing army, which itself is actually a legacy from the remnants of the 30 years. Well, we need to go back into the 17th century to understand Prussian militarism. They still had the Swedes in the country, and the Swedes had the nasty habit of rummaging and foraging around and doing not so nice things in the process. So the Prussians decided, in order to kick them out, they needed to have a small but highly efficient army. And then once they had built up that instrument, they didn't let go of it, I was about to say, up until like 1945, if not 1990. And one thing that led to the acceleration was Bismarck's attempt in mid-century to accelerate German unification and do this basically by warfare. In the course of this, they also occupied the Kingdom of Hanover. And for some reason that I still don't understand till today, the British did not intervene against him. Prussia had been an old ally from the Seven Years' War and the Napoleonic Wars. And so the British decided to swallow this, perhaps out of rivalry against France, and they were probably quite happy to see that the old Prussian ally was gaining in power and would be an effective counterbalancing weight against France. And if I may say so, that calculation was perhaps quite right. If anything, it was a bit too successful.
Interesting. I mean, the fluctuating waves of British intervention and non-intervention in the continent are something we might consider in another show. But just to take that model or that description up to date, so after the Second World War, when what was the Prussian Empire and then the Nazi Reich comes crashing down in the crushing defeat that was visited upon it by allies, we see Germany build again. And we see it build again through the so-called Wirtschaftswunder, the economic miracle that really set Germany up for the kind of trading nation it is today. What are the key features of that model, and what state is it in?
First, let's demystify the economic miracle of the 1950s a little bit, because it was basically a rebound effect, and there was a lot to rebound from. Let's not forget this. It was, first of all, the destruction dislocation from World War II. Also, the moral dislocation, let's never forget this, the moral dislocation that Nazi rule had meant, and the complete moral defeat that the Germans started to realize in 1945 when the gates of hell opened and the concentration camps opened. It was also a rebound from basically 20 years of economic depression and incomplete economic recovery after World War I. So it was like an accumulated effect that had dragged Germany and the European economy down more or less since 1914. Which makes for the spectacular economic growth rates we see in the 1950s. It is not necessarily miraculous economic policies, except that they found a good combination of a free market approach to economic policy and a relatively modern, by the standards of the time, relatively modern approach to welfare policies that was strong enough to create a sense of fairness among the Germans, but not too strong so it didn't suffocate the economy. Mm-hmm. These are things that, of course, need to be rebalanced and recalibrated in every generation. And they got that mixture right. Plus, tutelage and protection by the Americans.
Right. We'll come back onto that in just a second. But indeed, I mean, this rebound, plus then in some ways the privilege of relative backwardness, as Trotsky would have put it a long time ago, of being able to retool the German economy with the very latest stuff as was at the time, then set Germany up as that massive trading power. We know that later, from the 60s into the 70s, there was a moral regeneration and a cultural regeneration as well. And All this then comes together in the post-89 period, where Germany feels back on its moral feet, is also materially wealthy, and starts to set the agenda in the end of history period.
The end of history period, yeah, that was an interesting one indeed. It's interesting that you would mention 1990 as a watershed. It is perhaps one watershed is a little bit earlier, that's in the 1970s, when the German economy, so to speak, hits the historical trend again. The 1970s are more or less both the level and the slow growth that we would have seen had economic development more or less continued undisturbed since 1913. So that's basically when all the disruptions from the war economies and all that had washed out. But to understand why Germany became this trading power, as you call it, we mustn't look exclusively at like productivity and retooling, although all this is of course undoubtedly true. Largely, that's still within, let's say, the confines of rebound and recovery. The quantitatively and qualitatively new element is really the way the German economy was, the West German economy was put back on its feet financially, with the Allies allowing and actually fostering almost complete cancellation of Germany's old debt, which meant that German financial policy and also German monetary policy became a very easy task in the 1950s and 1960s. We all used to believe that this was just because of German balanced budget policies, of German austerity plus German ingenuity and all these things in German work ethics. All very true, but the task of monetary and fiscal policy in the 1960s was just so much easier than almost anywhere in Europe, which in a way explains these very favorable starting conditions and the very favorable position that Germany still had in 1990.
At which point the Schwabian Hausfrau goes regional and goes Europe-wide. I mean, the integration of the European single market, then the single currency, locks in certain advantages for Germany at a time when it buys in big time into the neoliberal globalizing model and into things that played to its advantage.
It also logs in certain German preferences, does it not? For example, if we look at the creation of the euro and the European Central Bank and, you know, a very specific inflation target as a result of German preference, no?
Let me cautiously disagree with that. You might as well say it locks in a French preference for mimicking what they consider to be German monetary and fiscal success. To some extent, it's the thinking of the time. You need a strong central bank, you need a strong independent central bank, and the Germans are providing that model. And Trichet's policy as head of the Bank of France back then is the franc fort, which is of course a pun on the place name of Frankfurt. And in a way, it's perhaps based on a misunderstanding of Germany's extremely privileged position after the war, which is not having to deal with the war debt, not having to inflate in order to inflate it away, not having to deal with large interest burdens on the public budget. It is misunderstood as German virtues when indeed it is perhaps a privilege to a large extent given to the Germans by the Allied military governments. The proof of the pudding is, to my mind, Germany's difficulty sticking to that model after the big shock that 1990 provides to the German economy. And this is something that, interestingly, we don't talk very much about anymore. And in your question, it was also the same thing, that we basically went straight on from 1990 to the single currency. Oh, there was something in between, which was a very bad fiscal and political and whatever shock called the German unification.
Yes, and I'd very much like to come back to that in more detail. But just to push this through into the present, we then see perhaps the spatial fix that is given to Germany. As you said, it was hitting the limits of some of that model, but we get a Eurozone which locks in favorable conditions for Germany in terms of exchange rates, in terms of borrowing rates and so on. Is that, then that's a huge advantage for Germany to really build on and cement its position as the leading exporting nation in Europe.
Yes and no. I have a bit of a difficulty with that because this presupposes intentionality that perhaps is not there. The Germans at the time had a big discussion about precisely these issues, and there were two schools of thought. One that was making more or less your point, saying we are cementing in something that is not going to work, because we are basically switching off the exchange rate mechanism as a balancing instrument, and once we switch this off, we need something else, which is fiscal policy, which is something we don't want to have, because it would basically mean giving up fiscal sovereignty. There were clear indications that neither would this be the preference of the German voter, nor would the German Constitutional Court allow this easily. So that was a bit of a barrier, and we've seen Germany hit this barrier several times, sometimes here, sometimes there. The other school of thought was saying, well, yes, it's true, we are having this misalignment of exchange rates, potentially an issue, but markets will be flexible enough to provide that adjustment. The pessimists turned out to be right, but also other things happened that nobody had anticipated, and that was the deluge of capital flows from Northern Europe to Southern Europe after the announcement of the common currency, which brought in a new problem that nobody had anticipated. I've looked at the old papers; nobody's talking about that.
Right, and so exactly that journey from big banana to big bazooka. Draghi's famous thing,
or
brings us to
banana.
That connection between economics and politics, which in a lot of the discussions we see in Germany tend to be rather falsely divorced, don't they, Aaron?
Yeah, well, I would certainly say so. But before we get to there, if we go back to the end of history period, for example, I sometimes wonder if we in Germany bought a bit too much into the whole end of history period and argument, simply because suddenly we had this huge economy that still required fuel and still required resources, and we were prepared to go just about anywhere for that, especially to the Russians and their gas and that sort of thing. And now we're
reaping the whirlwind, really.
Yeah, well, we're reaping the consequences. How did we get here? Does it come from buying into the end of history too much? Is there other things at play here?
I've never talked to Francis Fukuyama about this, but didn't he actually kind of copy a German concept here when he wrote this book about the end of history? I'll tell you why. Because
there's a Hegelian history of that.
Because Germany, Germany's end of history is the ground zero of 1945. There's no question about this. And then there's, so to speak, the world to come, so to speak, with the currency reform of 1948, which is like a rebirth in something akin to paradise. I always found it so very obvious. I went to high school equivalent in Germany, and we had very intense training in history, very good stuff. But what you could see is, although we learned every detail, the connection between pre-1945 Germany and post-1945 Germany was never really made. And in a way, I'm not a historian or a philosopher, really. I'm an economic historian. But the interesting thing in collective consciousness is that the way we talk in Germany about the past is highly ritualized. We have our altars, our temples, where history is being addressed. But a critical approach that looks at the element of continuity is something that became influential in academic circles, perhaps only in the past generation. In the past, I would say it's no longer than 20 or 30 years. And whether that really has kind of filtered through to the general educated population, I'm not fully sure. Which means, to my mind, Germany's educated classes, what they call the Bildungsbürgertum, is still in this kind of elevated, slightly lofty status of being disconnected from history. The final disconnect from history was the end of the Cold War, which in Germany happened not in 1989. In Germany, it happened in 1971, during the chancellorship of Willy Brandt, a former anti-Nazi resistance fighter, a social democrat. He had fled to Norway, survived the war in Sweden, came back and made a big career in social democracy, a guy who simply didn't have the Nazi whiff. He had full credibility, and he was the one who went to East Germany. He was the one who went to Poland, famously taking a knee in front of the Ghetto Memorial, and he went to Moscow. that was when in the mind of those Germans who were not old cold warriors with the brown whiff. That was the time when the Cold War ended in the mind of the Germans. And ever since the times of detente in politics, we've had this idea in Germany that you could do business with the Russians or with the Soviets, that you could do business with the Soviets, that you could deliver them gas pipelines. That was like the big thing, that much of this gas stuff was initially flowing through German-made pipelines. So that was the implicit deal that was made. We're coming to terms with the past also on the Eastern Front by recognizing the results of 1945 and by doing business with the Soviets.
Right, this is it. And so this is the separation I want to get to, because the Cold War does very much continue in Germany. The German army and defense spending at that time, we're talking 3.5% of GDP, 500,000 people under arms, 5,000 main battle tanks, a ground force that is the envy of NATO and appropriate to a frontline state, while at the same time engaging in this Ostpolitik, this rapprochement with the Eastern states. And it's then after the end of the Cold War, as everyone else sees it, that we go from Ostpolitik to Lostpolitik. And you actually have this economic imperative that comes to dominate practically everything and the denial of politics that goes with it.
Can I challenge you on that?
Can I challenge you on that?
I would like to draw a line of continuity from the late 1960s Ostpolitik to the post-1990s Ostpolitik. It's many of the same people, or it's basically the young people who had previously been their kind of junior co-workers, who then grow into the role and basically continue the same thing. So like Egon Bahr's young men, mostly men, who do the same thing after 1990. I would even argue, kind of on thin ice here, but even argue that in programmatic terms, it is really the continuation of the same policy. We see the same policy already in the 1920s when the Germans renew their reinsurance policies that Bismarck had started with respect to the Soviet Union. Not much happens because of the Nazis and all that. It is, so to speak, it is a basso continuo, as you would call it, music. A theme that has always been there and that kind of starts coming to the fore again in the late 1960s and becomes bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Wow. But I don't see discontinuity in this policy.
I think we are still seeing a little bit of a legacy of Ostpolitik. To come back to that for a quick second,
absolutely.
Even today, I mean, we still have social democrats, especially, who are very, very attached to Ostpolitik, both old and new. And we have a not insignificant number of Germans who basically say Ostpolitik is what is the reason why the wall fell, rather than, you know, East Germans or other Europeans demanding their freedoms.
Or the military might of NATO forcing costs on a Soviet Union that couldn't bear it.
Or just the economic mess that was the Soviet Union at the time. But no, it was Ostpolitik that did this. So, and we're seeing that in terms of, I think, a toxic legacy that goes all the way up to Ukraine. Is there any influence of Ostpolitik left in Germany today that needs addressing?
I would argue entirely so. I would think that what you're spelling out is basically sort of the continuation of the point that I was trying to make, and that was there before you or I were trying to make the point, because it is, to me, glaringly obvious that, yes, this is one of the structural constants, so to speak, of time-invariant constants of one element of German politics. To put it that way, we can go much further back. We can go much further back and can say that the two world wars were actually a dramatic and highly paradoxical departure from what had been consistent Prussian policy.
What I would push back on would be to say that I think you could see a continuation of a policy, but in a changed world. Doing the Ostpolitik economic engagement with a different economic system had the potential to push change in a positive direction that made a more secure connection and a more secure Europe. When it loses its power is when it becomes Wandel durch Handel and no pressure for positive change on the receiving end in Russia and elsewhere is made, and the change comes in Germany instead.
I see where you're going. That was a debate that was already raging inside inside German social democracy, basically between what in rough terms could be called the Willy Brandt wing of the party and the Helmut Schmidt wing of the party. Willy Brandt being a former resistance fighter who was decidedly not interested in German militarism, and Helmut Schmidt being a former Wehrmacht artillery officer who understood military matters all too well, and who shared views with on military matters with the military establishment inside the opposition party. There was the other guy who did a lot for post-war German remilitarization, Franz Josef Strauß of the Christian Social Union, the Bavarian.
Famously said, "The only thing to the right of me is the wall."
And that was one thing exactly. And these guys were in a grand coalition together in the late 1960s, famously called Plisch and Plum, because they were getting along with each other fine. So you see there is a bit of intersectionality, but there are also kind of overlapping circles, and it's never quite right to say there's only one thing. And that's also how we probably need to understand German politics and policies. On the one hand, there is this this policy line with Ostpolitik and this pro-Soviet and especially pro-Russian element, anti-Ukrainian element, also we come to this perhaps later. And there is a more pro-Western thing. And Schmidt was clearly the Atlanticist who spoke fluent English and was completely comfortable touring London and Washington, D.C. and to leave a good impression there. Whereas Willy Brandt was this kind of exotic figure there whose thinking was really like more within the old internal conflicts of social democracy and the labor movement, and whether one should go with the majority socialists or the minority socialists. He was more like with the Mensheviki and not the Bolsheviki. But his thinking is not Western European. These are policy strands that kind of overlap within the same party. It led to splits, it led to reunifications, it led to splits again.
Right. I mean, this is always why the challenge of strict periodization is never going to be fully met. One thing to read is to look up Helmut Schmidt's speech to the IISS, the Institute of International and Strategic Studies in London in 1977 on deterrence remains one of the classics of the genre. And there's a link to that in our show notes. But let's take this to where you, drawing some of your strands together, Albrecht, taking this as a policy that looked towards the East, that overlooked the Zwischenländer, the countries in between, and looked straight to Russia. That's what we've heard a lot of accusations of in the last couple of years. And so this latent German imperial gaze that looks to Russia and overlooks the lands in between, which then came to find its expression in the prioritization of economics over politics in the last years?
Well, I think, we see this, I think, certainly with how Nord Stream 2 was handled, for example. All kinds of warnings from Central and Eastern Europe, and also from Ukraine. I mean, this is something that President Zelensky addressed quite pointedly in his speech to the Bundestag. We always warned you that Nord Stream 2 would be used as a weapon. Instead, you insisted it was business, business, business. And this sort of pretending that Nord Stream 2 was only a commercial endeavor, something that was said over and over again, and ignoring, of course, that it has political implications. But how is this even, where does that come from in German political culture and even among the public, this tendency to just pretend that economic issues are not, in fact, political ones or security ones?
Now, here we probably get to some uncomfortable historical evidence. Think about the map of Europe in 1914. Mm-hmm. More precisely about the map of Eastern Europe, I would be hard-pressed to find more than three states there. One is Prussia, the second one is the Habsburg monarchy, dominated by ethnic Germans. Of course the Austrians are not Germans anymore, which is fine, but that was the situation.
Apologies to all our Austrians.
And the third one is Russia. And what did these three powers do? They divided Europe.
Right.
They divided Eastern Europe for mutual benefit.
So did we basically ditch the imperial mindset, you know, or pretend that we ditched it only for ourselves in Germany? Because it seems that we still think in a very imperial way, right? And I think this is what Ben is getting at.
Dealing with primarily great powers, looking mainly to Russia or to the US to take your cue, ignoring those smaller states in between. Does seem, again, a continuity, Albrecht. Do you think so as well?
the Germans look to Bismarck in a way that is perhaps even more positive than the way the British looked towards Disraeli, and these are two completely different figures. And Bismarck's policy was essentially to maintain a reactionary business model, a politics model, that had just been stabilized in the 1848 revolution with, let's not forget, a Russian military intervention in Hungary against the Hungarian uprising. That was an entente. It worked fine under Bismarck. His big difficulty was, how can we stabilize that and not entirely antagonize the Western powers, which under his successors broke down. Then they antagonized everybody and waged war against everybody until everything had been destroyed. What is the innovation that comes in after World War II? It's the American backing. It's an irony of history that Germany felt free to pursue more Ostpolitik precisely because the Americans had their back. It is like taking a free ride on NATO and on the Americans. At the same time, the Germans knew they had the liberty to do this, or they were at ease doing this, because America, in some olden days, which now seem to be past, seemed to see no alternative to supporting this. From a German viewpoint, if you basically consider the old mindset that the Polish are accusing us of and the Ukrainians in a slightly more polite fashion now that Melnik is in Brazil are accusing us of, the old German mindset is that there is no conflict with the Russians. With the Russians, not the Soviet Union, with the Russians. Mm-hmm, right. Because we can always divide and conquer. But we don't do the conquering thing. That has gone out of fashion in Germany a little bit. We leave this to others. But from a German viewpoint, Ukraine is a Russian matter. From the traditional German viewpoint. From the traditional German viewpoint, Ukraine is a Russian matter. Germany challenged this view twice in the 20th century. First in 1918, when Ukraine was occupied by German troops. This is something that has been conveniently forgotten in German historiography. Some experts still talk about this, not too often. Others get invited. And it was challenged again in 1941 with disastrous results. So the German automatic reaction would always be, we burned our fingers twice, we set Europe aflame in the process, we emerged from with destroyed cities, 10 million refugees, and a moral defeat that knows no parallel in history.
A country and a culture in ruins.
Yes, exactly. Sorry if I psychoanalyze this a little bit too much here. I would not be surprised if that is one of the reasons why it is really very difficult for Germany's political class to come around to the idea that we should now support Ukraine against Russian imperialism. Challenging Russian dominion over Ukraine was done twice in the 20th century. It didn't work out well. And most Germans, if you ask them, probably have this idea, we don't touch it. We don't go there anymore.
This is still that great power thinking. It's still spheres of influence and exactly...
Entirely.
Betide those who don't live in a great power.
Entirely. And but look...
It's still in our mindset, even if we're not, you know, as you say, doing the military conquest thing the same way anymore.
Look at the economic facts. And then you will see that German economic penetration of East Central Europe is higher than it was in 1938 and is probably at the level of 1914. One of the reasons why, to come back to the Euro crisis and to come back to the Southern Europeans, why the Southern Europeans found themselves in a less uncomfortable position after the opening of the wall was that all these industrial districts of East Central Europe came back. And why did they come back? Because they have a fantastic location close to the hub that Germany is in the economic geography of Europe.
Well, right. I mean, the Czech economic journalists refer to Bohemia as the 17th Bundesland in this. And again, you find that coincidence of resources, skills, infrastructure, and connection, and location.
Western Poland is the 18th month. We can add to the list. Yeah.
Forgetting Majorca, of course.
And the Lega Nord in Italy can't really claim or say it openly. Northern Italy is, of course, part of Germany's supply chain as well now. Talking about great power thinking. This is what German industrialists have in mind.
Right, and that's why they love doing business with the Russians, because they think the same way.
The business with the Russians itself is not the most important thing. The important thing is to have quiet on the Eastern Front. This is extremely cynical, I know, but the automatic thinking, before you start thinking about it more deeply, about in the way of what am I thinking here actually, but the automatic thinking would be we don't need conflict there. What we need is stable business conditions. Not so much perhaps because of the Russian business itself, but simply in order to have easy market access to the rest of Europe.
Actually, I do think some of your cynicism is probably well-founded. I mean, we have seen rumors in the last couple of days even in the chancellery right now, in the Scholz chancellery, there are officials that are very keen to be the first to re-engage Russia after the war is all over, right?
And a big hello to all our listeners in the Kanzleramt.
Yes, exactly. So, to come to that, I think...
The good thing is that I don't need to take a position on that, because for me, the world begins only when the archives open. That's with a delay of 25 to 30 years.
But we have...
In 30 years. When
But for others, the judgment begins now, right, Aaron?
Yeah, well, we have talked on this on the show about how the German public's attitude might be changing with some of these questions, but we do still see that the political elites are still very, very much still influenced by old thinking. The want to re-engage with Russia, this sort of stuff. You've now lived in the UK for 16 years. Why can't Germans, particularly elites, but perhaps also the public here, understand how bad this all looks? Particularly something like that, that you know, someone wants to re-engage with Russia again and just go back to business as usual. Why don't we seem to be able to get that? That just looks really, really, really bad.
Okay, I give an honest answer to that, which is that great power thinking is not really about what do the others think about us. That's not really in the set. That's not really in the set. And I don't say this with any malice. When I'm talking to my friends in London about 18th or 19th century, especially England was not just a small Celtic village defending itself heroically against the European Union, then I can also see there's very, very little sensitivity, very little openness towards what did we actually do. It's not really on the screen. The Germans have learned to be highly self-critical in one dimension, and that's dealing with the consequence of the Shoah, of the Holocaust. And even that is highly ritualized, but I don't want to in any way belittle this. There clearly has been at least publicly a turnaround.
But memory and culture misses the rest of it.
And it's selective memory culture.
It is selective. It is selective, absolutely. But let's not forget that historically Germany is not a small country. It used to be this myriad of micro-territories having a dream of national unity, and it became... one of the great powers of Europe, then messed it up as completely as possible, and by what is a miracle, found itself to be at least economically a great power again. Nevertheless, again, let me take issue with something that you kind of said as an aside, which is that old thinking is still completely influential. I think we need to give people credit for changing their thinking slowly, perhaps too slowly. We will perhaps see that it is going to be more persistent. The kind of rebalancing the persistent position might be more persistent than we think. So in case there really are people in leading policy circles that believe he could go back to business as usual with the Russians, in case there are such people who still think that, they would perhaps wake up one day and have a rude awakening and realize that this is not how German politics is going. What I'm saying is Zeitenwende is incredibly slow to materialize, and I see many entries on ex-Twitter by people from think tanks in Berlin being very impatient. Nevertheless,
thank you.
Nevertheless, if I may say,
Hello, everyone.
The big LNG tanker called MS Germany is moving degree by degree by degree. It's very, very slow. I don't think there's a going back anytime soon. I'd be surprised.
Sure, but I mean, degree by degree by degree is fine, while Ukrainian by Ukrainian by Ukrainian dies.
Absolutely.
And this is also why there's an impatience. Not only that, because the imperative for Russia to lose, which would surely, if Germany were to play the contributory role it should in that, be the end of the kind of thinking you mentioned before, that would be the sign of a Zeitenwende for Ukraine to win, to be able to assert its self-determination in a way that some of the lands of the Habsburg Empire in the past were able to do. And they didn't get that for free. They also got it with American backing from Wilson and others. We know that. But it's exactly that shift that would surely be a Zeitenwende.
And also, I think Germany to very clearly come out and support, for example, Ukrainian accession to the to NATO in particular, I mean, also to the EU, but it has already voiced support for this. I mean, that's, I think, perhaps one of the first signs that we have changing thinking that says, okay, we don't really consider Ukraine everything, to be a Russian matter.
Exactly. Everything in this regard is going to happen much later than we think and much later than would be good. There's absolutely no doubt about this. As I said, German mentality is a little bit to be a latecomer to everything and then do this with do things with German thoroughness, which is not always good. Which is not always good because Germans then can become, in the same way that the certain lack of flexibility of German thinking, the rigidity that people observe and notice very strongly when they come to this country, in the way that this immobilism makes them very very slow to perform policy turns, that rigidity also works the other way around. That's why I'm not so sure that we will really get a reversal to the previous politics of us. Too much has happened already. And so I'm hedging my bets a little bit. But that said, of course, it is obvious that other possible paths of German policy could be imagined and that the consequences of those might be much preferable.
Picking up on what you said before, again, it's never either one thing or the other. These things are in competition, and this is what the large business of politics actually is those different impulses and actually which one can gain the upper hand in different ways. Then when particular turning points emerge, it's the result of long, complex action coming together. Often, as you said, a strategy without a strategist sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then actually taking through and dealing with the legacies of the past. Still, I've just been so struck by many of the things you said. Is what difference has it made to you to live abroad for 16 years, to be able to reflect on Germany?
The question goes very deep. We would have to go all the way back to 1939. That takes too long. My grandparents told me how here in Berlin they were basically putting a duvet over the radio, listening to the BBC, and not believing in the early days of September that they promised a counterattack and the West would not be forthcoming. These and other tales have deeply influenced my thinking. So that kind of going abroad and looking at Germany from abroad is not entirely coincidental. There are deeper reasons for that.
Given all we've said about Germany's positioning, how is it set to fare in the changing geopolitical and geoeconomic world we see?
You've probably heard about German Angst.
Never, ever.
Okay. So in Germany, in German culture, we have this thing of believing that that the end of days is nigh, and that it's not going to be pretty, and that we might be on the losing side. I don't know why this is. Germany has been a net exporter of ideologies, usually with a heavy negativist component, since the times of the Anabaptists and perhaps even earlier. So I'm not surprised that everybody is super pessimistic. I'd like to put things into perspective a little bit. We've had lots of complaints, also in this interview implicitly, about Germany's export power and how Germany was basically exporting and producing and if that's an English word, austerity, I know it's not a word, but let me make it up on the fly, it's neighboring trade partners to the ground. Now we see for the first time in 18 years that Germany is again being called the Sigma of Europe. It's a bit of an exaggeration. Not quite. Germany's engineering schools haven't closed down yet, although I do understand they have difficulty recruiting students. And I hear these stories of how everybody wants to be a civil servant or an academic historian or something like that. If possible, of course, on a safe lifetime position.
Right, the land of civil servants, historians and lawyers, which will eat itself.
Exactly, all this is true, but nevertheless, there's still awesome export surpluses. It's true that German manufacturing is being challenged technologically. Let's not forget that there are several technological revolutions that Germany simply has missed. The digital revolution, no-show, consumer electronics. They used to be very strong on this in the 1960s.
On digitalization, we live here, you don't have to convince us.
Yeah,
so,
no.
So all these things are an issue. In Britain, it's like the other way around. As soon as it's digital, it works. Nothing else works unless it works with German technology. So, Germany has missed a few things already. We need to see what happens next. It is not entirely clear. It has bounced back in the past. There is still a fighting chance it will bounce back right now. But let me kind of pin this down to one thing that everybody is talking about, and that is, again, energy supplies. There is of course, an issue with gas. The misrepresentation is that Germany used to be built on cheap Russian gas, and now that this is no longer there, the German business model is finished. That is simply not quite true.
Very politely put, that was that influence of 16 years in the UK.
I used to put things in more in American terms, so try to not to anymore. The fact is that there is a world market for fossil fuels. If anything, there might be carbon leakage. We've had a very controversial discussion in Germany recently about what actually happens to fossil fuel prices internationally if Germany continues its attempts to get out of that unilaterally without international cooperation. All this is there. But you can't have it both ways. You cannot at the same time say that there is this big international market where Germany's effects as a major user of energy are going to affect on prices, and at the same time say Germany is toast because Nord Stream 2 has been blown up. That's not quite going to work. So the real issue is that two things are coming together here. One is we are having this war between Russia and Ukraine, which is also economic warfare of Russia against the West, with the Russians being in a slightly mixed position here. And the other thing that we have is that Germany is desperately trying to move out of fossil fuels with mixed chances of success. Taking those two things together, it does not seem clear to me that Germany in the future is no longer going to be a location where you can do energy-intensive production. The problem is not the location, the problem is its politics. And again, German energy politics, it's a little bit at a crossroads. They can't have it both ways. They know about it. If you press them on this, that would lead us far afield. They say things which seem to be slightly self-contradictory. So we need to see what happens over time. What I can see is that the lobbyists and industrial representatives are presenting things in a very, very bleak colors. That's understandable. But of course, don't forget the interest behind this. I do think the German economy is going to live to see another day.
Yeah, I mean, somewhere between Pangloss and Panglum, there is likely to be the future of the German economy. But it's not just energy. Germany is dependent in other ways on other parts of the world, particularly on China. We know this not only for materials and its green transition, but for large parts of the trade model on which it's relied on, which has, to be honest, served the interest of certain German companies rather than the German people at large. But there are a lot of people, even in our own institution, continuing to argue for that neoliberal globalization and trade model to continue in as much an unaltered way as possible. Is that viable?
I don't know what the neoliberal trade model is. Being a neoliberal economist myself by training, yes, there's something called comparative advantage. The question is if it applies to China. And actually, I have doubts about that. The reason being that the Chinese have been very good at tweaking their model to create export surpluses, to create high growth. That model has produced interesting results in recent years. You could say the Chinese motor is spluttering. And my own assessment, not so much from a political side, but rather from the side of very basic neoclassical economics is that, to use a German proverb, even in China, trees are not going to grow into heaven, and we might see a downward adjustment. You more and more see economists writing about a comparison with Japan in the 1990s. I've made that comparison in the past. I remember writing papers on about this like 5 years ago. The writing was on the wall, and many of the industrialists who think that the Chinese market is the future might have to recalibrate their expectations. But to be very honest, although we can make some pattern predictions, nobody has a crystal ball, and we simply can't know. It is very, very difficult to deglobalize, to cut yourself off from the market, except if you want to do this for military reasons. So one way of looking at this, at international economic history, is to say you basically see two regimes. One is economic war preparation with autarky, and the other one is free trade, or something akin to free trade. And there is no good economic model for combining repatriation of supply chains with a free market model. And the simple economic reason is that prices are not very good measurements for that. So if you just let things go, the price mechanism is always basically give you minimal cost combinations. And that usually is not the political cost that you would have to see. And there is no good way of mapping that trade-off into prices, because you would have to have a lot of knowledge that you don't have. I see many initiatives also in the European Unions and with the Americans who kind of try to reinvent the wheel and somehow provide this information and do that. It is not easy to predict that this is going to be very costly, have only partial success, and that we will have this conversation, or somebody will have similar conversations in many, many years down the road. The one thing that gives me hope is that Chinese supergrowth is not going to continue.
No, indeed, this notion of peak China, and I think the comparison to Japan in the 90s, the last threat from Asia that was going to get us all, is well made. At the same time, the difficulties firms have had in properly pricing in geopolitical risk, the externalities, the societal externalities that that brings, does rather put the focus once back more onto government to help provide those guidelines and guide rails, not in a way that would replace the price mechanism or the market mechanism, but that would supplement it.
I don't see how to do this easily. I know it has been a talking point of many, but doing this properly would require a huge interventionist machinery that in the end basically returns to things like reglemented trade, foreign exchange control, or capital controls. I'm very skeptical about the current talk that we hear about kind of again having it both ways. Well, it's not easy. Like almost everything in economic history is evidence against it.
I wonder if for a minute we're talking about reshoring or friendshoring. Of course, those things are different. Reshoring might be, you might find a little bit more of that in the United States Inflation Reduction Act, for example. The idea of repatriating your supply chains, as you say. But friendshoring is a little bit different. How would you view that? Because it's not really entirely about repatriating your supply chain back to you alone, but simply also to it does leave room for other countries that are perhaps a bit more friendly to you.
It's a lovely idea, but I don't know how it's going to work without a control bureaucracy. All these are nice ideas that they can put on PowerPoint presentations, but the neoclassical economist is telling you what in the end matters is prices and profit. And if you bring production back onshore, the question is how much you pay for this. I was talking to somebody the other day, an expert on batteries, who explained to me that purifying lithium in China costs, what was it, 10,000 a ton. And if you do this in America and Europe, it costs 30,000. So who is going to pay the difference? So it's all very nice. And there are now the first voices coming out challenging the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States, saying that really, if you look at the effects on the ground, there is very little going on. So there is much noise and very little signal.
We're going to be hearing more about exactly that from Sandra Tordoir and Claudia Schmucker shortly for our conversation with them. But Albrecht, so much of this strikes me as the conversation between politicians and economists that has long gone on about what drives and what ultimately ensures prosperity versus how to actually weigh that against other considerations and how to distribute those gains. And this partly also the reaction to what is neoliberal globalization. Everyone in politics knows what neoliberal globalization is. No one in economics claims to know what it is at all. And that's part of that combination.
Yes, exactly. But the thing is, yeah, that's correct. But the thing is that politicians can give us no implementation mechanism. And what economics can say, be very careful with that, because there is a lot of historical experience with that stuff, with interventionist foreign policies, going back to mercantilism.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You can, of course, do it, but at huge social cost. And will you get support in the population if you don't even get support for climate change, which is much more important, honestly?
Well,
Then how about this? That's why I'm saying. Sorry to be the party party pooper here, but it's very nice to spell out lovely policy goals that I would share. It's not that I'm a cold neoliberal whatever economist who says I don't want it. All these would be good things. Climate change is the best example. Would be wonderful to have, but show me an implementation mechanism that works. And we need to be very, very skeptical, I'm sorry to say.
Well, also sorry to say, there's a fair amount of evidence from the last 40 years that the other system had its issues as well, be they social, be they implementation or otherwise.
And indeed, it's that process of working through what have been the problematic elements of neoliberalism, as some would call it, or the economic arrangements of the last 40 years, as others might describe them, and working out what are true alternatives to them, that is a big part not only of future economic policy, but actually of ensuring the prosperity that will underpin our security in the free world going forward. And getting those things right together, economics and politics together, geopolitics and geoeconomics together, rather than trying to work them out in isolation and risking the tendency they become contradictory, that is a big task for liberal democracies going forward, and one that Berlin Side Out and the action group Zeitenwende certainly try to support.
Yes, and that's precisely why we were very happy to have Albrecht on with us today, partly because in order to be able to chart that better future that we talk about for our democracies, for our liberal democracies, including Germany, we do have to have a better understanding of our past. And we talk about that a lot on Berlin Side Out too, the role of our collective memory in charting our course forward. So we definitely hope that our discussion with Albrecht has helped our listeners to understand that.
And listeners of Berlin Side Out, we have a treat for you in exactly that regard coming up, as the academic and expert Chris Miller, author of the book, the best-selling book, Chip War, will come to talk to us about those historical and contemporary connections between geopolitics and geoeconomics, viewed through the particular and particularly important prism of the semiconductor industry.
And we're definitely looking forward to that, as well as the rest of the season, where we get further into those aspects that Chris will also be talking about, systemic competition and how that chip war fits into that, as well as to the greater context of that competition. For now, that's all for this episode of Berlin Side Out. Thank you very much to our guest today, Albrecht Ritschel, our project assistant, Julian Stuckle, our technical producer, Hendrik Banner, and the DEGAPE team from Berlin. Auf Wiedersehen and tschüss.